How did you get into politics? Was it what made you decide that that was the way to go?
But one day I just lost my mind and decided to run.
From Topic Studios and WarnerMedia Podcast Network, this is Politically Reactive. I'm W. Kamau Bell.
And I'm Bowdoin College's most famous alum since Nathaniel Hawthorne. It's me, Hari Kondabolu.
We're two comedians trying to make sense of American politics.
Why do we leave that line in there every week? Why? Why do we do that? Because we're not going to make sense of it, but we leave it in there every week.
We'll talk to the people doing the hard work to revive our democracy and hopefully speak some truth to power.
Like California Congresswoman Katie Porter, who can make corporate CEOs squirm just by pulling out her dry erase board.
Any increase in the price of Revlimid would also increase your bonus by increasing earnings. Isn't that right, Mr. Ellis?
If revenues increased and expenses did not, then earnings would be enhanced. And
thank you, Mr. Ellis. In fact, the Oversight Committee found that if you hadn't increased the price of Revlimid, you wouldn't have gotten your bonus.
She's the first Democrat ever to represent her district in, wait for it, Orange County. We'll hear how she's turned that red district blue and how she's supporting progressive candidates across the country.
Then it's time for the demonhood segment. Oh, sorry, the fatherhood segment of the episode.
We'll talk to Caroline Rose Giuliani, filmmaker and daughter of, yes, Rudy Giuliani.
I'm Rudy Giuliani's daughter, and I'm fucking awesome.
She's made a hard break from her dad's right-wing politics and recently wrote a piece for Vanity Fair calling on people to vote for Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. I guess someone's out of the will.
Yep, we'll hear what it's like to wake up every day knowing that your dad might be in the headlines for the wrong reasons, or the new Borat movie for the wrong reasons.
And after that, we'll talk to a New York City resident who's become a citizen after living here for more than 40 years and who's voting for the first time in 2020. It's my dad, Ravi Kondabolu.
You better not vote for Jill Stein. It's all coming up on Politically Reactive. Hey, Harry.
Hey, man, how are you?
I'm in Philadelphia.
I don't know why I laugh there. I think it's just funny because, like, it's not funny, but the fact you're traveling is shocking to me. Like,
yeah.
You were actually, because I saw a picture of you on Instagram and you had a whole thing. Yeah, it was like it's not quite a gas mask, but it was like a full plastic or rubber facial covering.
Well, it's the thing you see like essential workers using. It's just a plastic thing that covers your whole face. And then I had a regular mask on under that because that's the way I saw Lisa Ling do it that way. And I saw LeVar Burton do it that way. And I thought, good enough for those two, good enough for me. So it's my first flight since March. And, you know, was I freaked out? Yes, I was. And so like, that's
jeez,
how I went.
Man. Well, what if you had to take a sip of water? What'd you do?
Well, that's also weird because they still like give you like some water to drink, and you just feel like it's like a whole like I felt very conscious of like opening up the water, drinking it quickly, closing it quickly, because I just was afraid to be that person who sort of forgot and was just sitting there all Ted Cruz style with his mask off. So yeah, it was the whole thing was very anxiety producing. And because I'm shooting United Shades, I then land, and then like the next day I got like a COVID test, and I get COVID tested every day. And so I, you know, so that's great to know, but it's just also like, yeah, I never thought that I would be flying again when we were so still not in any way handling the pandemic. And also that it's actually gotten worse again, as all the news has said. It's like, it's as bad as it ever was and getting a little bit worse. Happy to be working. Also don't want to get COVID. It's a mixed blessing, as we say.
They're paying you pretty good though, right?
I mean, I'm not trying to act like this is the thing. That's the hard part. Yes, I get paid to do the show. Yes, it's how I make a living and provide for my family. But here's the other thing that I think about, that even if I was like, oh, well, I don't want to do it. Like, there's a lot of people who work on the show. It's not me and my iPhone making the show. So there is also, and I'm not trying to say, there's sort of like, we make the show. This is what we do. And I trust that we're all working as hard as we can to not get COVID. But yeah, it's also kind of like, here's the thing. I'm not trying to complain. It's also just happens to be an anxiety filled time generally in this country for many of us. So it's like there's my regular life anxiety that I have. Then there's this sort of COVID pandemic, social unrest. and then the election, and then wildfires in California, and then, oh, time to get back on a plane and go back to work. Oh, PG&E turned the power out of my house where my family is because of the wildfires. Oh, I can't get a good cheesesteak in Philly because Uber Eats doesn't deliver from the good places. So other than that, everything's free.
I didn't know. Is that true about Uber Eats?
I don't know. That's the only thing I've been. I'm really not trying to even hit on Uber Eats. I'm just trying to say that like all the food is delivery, and by the time it gets there, you know, cheesesteak tastes best when it's like you're there.
No, yeah. I hear you. I haven't had a acai bowl the way I've wanted to in months. It's always melted by the time it gets to you.
Yeah. So I mean, I think what we're trying to say, audience, is that we're complaining about the little things. So I don't think about like catching COVID and dying because I'm literally a walking comorbidity. All the things they say that all the sort of the preconditions for COVID, I am them. I'm black.
Is it that small?
I'm
Are
older.
These small complaints?
I mean, no, not the fear of not getting COVID is not a
no, small, not that. Yeah. But like, I mean, I think it's not that unreasonable to be like, hey, I wanted an acai bowl, not a smoothie. Is that, am I out of touch? Oh.
So how are you doing? Yeah. You recently had a birthday.
I turned 38 this this month.
Wow.
That's nutty. And the thing, I stopped caring about birthdays maybe around 30.
Mm-hmm.
So I already was kind of like really not into it to begin with. And then having a kid, it's like, who cares about my stupid birthday? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. No, you're right. You're right to feel that way.
Like, I mean, year to year, nothing really changes when you're just getting closer to death. A kid month to month at this age, huge changes. That's exciting.
Well, that's the best way to be. You have to stop. You have to really invest less in your own personal celebrations when you have a kid. You have to just sort of like, if people remember, great. If they don't, you just have to be okay with that. And also, at 38, you're finally the age I thought you were when I met you.
Right. Yeah, I finally caught up to the age my soul was.
Yeah, when I met you and you're like, I'm 27. I'm like, you're 27? I thought we were like, I was looking for a mentor. I thought you were my new mentor.
I mean, I realized too that my birthday has been devalued by others too. Like, my mom called that morning and, you know, I put her on the phone with Arjun, and of course she's happy, and then hands the phone to my father. My father is just talking to Arjun and being silly, and then all of a sudden I hear a whisper, it's Ari's birthday. And my dad's, oh yeah, happy birthday, Ari. It's like, don't you try to slip that in now.
Well, it's interesting that you bring up your dad because he will be a guest on the show today.
Yeah. I mean, part of it is that I think my mom gets a lot more offers in show business than my father does. He gets a lot more. She gets a lot more love, I think, than he does. And he, as a new citizen who is about to vote for the first time, I felt like this was the time for my father to get a little bit of shine. So we have an interview with my pops later in the show.
And we also have an interview with your new friend, Caroline Rose Giuliani.
Yeah, it is gutsy. She wrote an article in Vanity Fair basically saying, ugh, my dad was Rudy Giuliani. Don't get me started. Also, please vote for Biden and Kamala Harris. I mean, it was, I read it and I'm like, oh, we should have her on. And, you know, I did everything in my power to be nice. About her father, not to her, but about her. I wanted to say lots of terrible things about her father, and I held back. Like, your father might have killed homeless people. I'm just saying, but I kept it in. I kept it in.
God. Yeah, you did keep that in. I mean, she's already going pretty hard in the paint against her dad. So there's
Abner Louima, Amadou Diallo. I'm just saying, you're dead.
You know. Everybody has a parent.
She knows. It's not like she doesn't know. And she's honest, and she's quite like, she's very nice and she's very thoughtful. And I think a part of her winces every time. Mm-hmm. I think she was probably wincing when she wrote the article, and I think it's gutsy. It's a gutsy thing to do.
But before we do that, we're gonna talk to Representative Katie Porter, who's is she the Sarah Cooper of Congress people? Like the viral, like she makes a lot of viral videos.
Man, I never knew a dry erase board could be so exciting.
I have one and it's never done anything for me. It just always has like goals that I don't accomplish.
I wanted to ask her if she was embarrassed that during that viral video she had with the Revlimid executive, that her handwriting wasn't straight, like it was on a slant. But I decided not to, because that would be a stupid thing to do.
Yeah, she would have whipped out the whiteboard on you at that point. Congresswoman Katie Porter represents California's 45th district in Congress, and that's in South Central Orange County, which is nothing like South Central LA.
And in her first term in Congress, she's distinguished herself by using that underused tool of democracy, no, not voting, the whiteboard.
She's used it to take on corporate CEOs and underperforming regulators. Let's talk to Katie Porter and hope she doesn't pull it out on us. Thank you for being a guest. We're very excited to have you. You're my Patronus. Thank you for, you know, you replaced Rachel Maddow, who was my Patronus for years. So thank you for coming on. We don't normally talk to politicians in office because, you know, sometimes you sort of have to end up asking about all the controversies they've been involved with. But I Googled you before this. I put Katie Porter controversy and Google's like, I got nothing. So thank you for that.
Let's keep it that way.
Yes, we're super, super excited that you're here. Obviously, that clip of you destroying that executive went viral and was so enjoyable to watch.
Which one? She's got multiple.
You can take your choice. We have big banks, big pharma, big military.
Big Ben Carson, little Ben Carson.
I mean, they're almost like congressperson instructional videos at this point. This is how you do your job. And it's incredible to watch. At this point, when you are you know, talking to someone, when you're interviewing them in that way, do you see the potential of that interaction going viral and being able to educate tons of people? Like, and when you were doing that particular one, were you surprised that it took off the way it did?
This is not like I just wing it. Like with, you know, so many things like comedy, there's a lot of thought that goes into it, to developing your style, to thinking about how to connect with people, because that's really what good governance is about. It's about building that connection with the people that you represent, the American public in my case, and Orange County families in particular. And so we'll spend a lot of time thinking broadly about topics. Do we want to ask about this kind of greed from the executive or that kind of corporate malfeasance from the executive, right? So we have to make those kinds of trade-offs. And then we try to develop a series of questions, really spending as much time on what I'm going to say as on what the witness is going to say. And I think too many politicians and elected officials and candidates too are focused too much on their words and not enough on the back and forth of the dialogue. And so we really try to think about, well, if the witness maybe is, I don't want to say lies, but is less than truthful, you know, what are we going to say? If the witness doesn't know what they're doing, what are we going to do? So we try to map that out. So I don't really know that I ever have a sense of what's going to resonate, but I do try at the beginning of every hearing to ask myself, you know, as a mom, as a single mom, as a mom of three, as a mom who wants to sometimes kill her children, what is on my mind, right? And it's things like the high price of prescription drugs. It's things like, why can't we get our schools opened? It's those kinds of things. How about coronavirus testing? And so I try to think about how to connect with the public. Whether it goes viral or not is really up to how well the American public feels like I'm hearing them.
I mean, it feels like it's built for that, because it's almost watching that the famous clip. It was like a 4-minute Law and Order cross-examination. Everything put in its perfect place and absolutely devastating.
Well, I have to say, I mean, sometimes we have a good sense of how they're going to unfold, but there is no preparing for somebody who confuses a foreclosure with a chocolate sandwich cookie. I wrote those questions myself on my little iPhone on the airplane. I spent years trying to help families avoid foreclosure. It had this problem of blighted properties and decay in neighborhoods and not returning these low-income properties to potential owners, who had bothered me for years. So I was like, you know what? I'm finally in Congress. I'm going to ask why you don't fix this. But it turned out I couldn't really ask that, because he had no idea what I was talking about. So you just can't plan for some moments.
I mean, it was very clear in that moment that you had to like, wait, what? To be clear for the audience, that was when you asked Ben Carson about Oreos, and he was like, I know what Oreos are. He tried to be a little cute with you, and you weren't having any of that.
No, and I think one of the things is, having been a professor and being a parent, I think you get pretty good at detecting the people who are trying to fake you out. And there's a lot of that, you know, frankly, BS that goes on in Washington. And I see it sometimes even from my colleagues where they're like, I really care about that issue. Mm. They have no idea what they're talking about. Mm. So there's a lot on our plates. It's hard to keep up. But the witnesses are there to educate us. They're there because they are supposed to be experts. So it's absolutely fair to hold their feet to the fire in that way.
It's funny you brought up being a mom, which I appreciate, because when the first time I saw you, first of all, there's so many members of Congress. Sometimes we don't even know who our own congresspeople are. Mine is Barbara Lee. Shout out to Barbara Lee. But that I got that like head of the PTA energy from you. You know what I mean? That like that concerned citizen. And then it was like, when I looked you up, I was like, oh, she's a law professor. So when you're doing that, are you bringing the concerned citizen energy and sort of putting the law professor aside? Or is that also how you were a law professor?
Elected official that's actually about teaching. And I don't hear other elected officials talking about this. But one of our problems is, how do we get the very busy American public who's trying to make ends meet, who's trying to stay safe from COVID, who's going to figure out what are they going to send grandma for, you know, a birthday gift, given that they can't go see her because of COVID? How are they going to pay for gas for their car that day or put food on the table? How do we engage them in understanding what the policy decisions are and helping being a force to push Congress toward meeting their needs? So when I questioned Jamie Dimon, who's the CEO of JP Morgan Bank, about how a single mom with one school-age kid couldn't make ends meet working at his bank, one of the things that made me really happy is the number of people who said, that's my life. Mm. That's my kid's life. That was my life. Thank you for seeing me. And so I think there's a lot about this that is about connecting with people. And that's what good teachers do. I used to teach something. Now hold it, because this is going to be exciting. Called the Uniform Commercial Code. Now, that is a hot topic. I mean, if it doesn't sound interesting to you, I can't help you. Uniform Commercial Code. So when you teach things like the three elements of a security interest, you have to be the party. You really have to think about, how am I going to make this come alive for the students? And I think it's a lot of the same kinds of things. So I think too many elected officials have the idea that they're important and that everyone's listening to what they're saying. The reality is, we have an obligation to help show the American people why what we're saying is important and why what they do next with that information matters to our democracy.
Kamau and I are both stand-up comedians who've performed in Orange County. And with that being said,
I'm glad you made it.
But having that experience, I have to ask you, how did you as a progressive win Orange County?
I think by being a very straight shooter. I mean, there is going to be, there should be room for disagreement in a democracy. We can't be afraid of ideas. And I'd like elected officials of both parties to say that. We shouldn't be suppressing debate. So I have many Republican constituents. I have many Democratic constituents. I have independent constituents, young, old, brown, black. My job is to listen to them, and then to hear their situation, to explain to them, to share facts or information or research that I have, and to do that in a respectful, civil way. And so what I've been very clear about is, I'm going to keep my promises. I'm going to tell you what I'm going to do. I'm unafraid to take any question. So one of my favorite things to do pre-COVID was, we had in-person town halls, and I bought this amazing, gigantic, I can't even really show you how big it is, gigantic bingo ball spinner, like they use in, you know, in the bingo halls. And people write their questions on an index card and put it into that bingo ball spinner. We spin it and I draw out a question. Why do I do that? Because I don't just want the noisiest people to be heard. I want every single person who comes to my town hall, whether they're shy, whether they're sitting in the front row or they arrived, you know, late in the back, whether they're willing to put their hand in their air or they feel like they need some anonymity to raise that concern, I want them to have an equal voice in our democracy.
You've mentioned, we've talked about the whiteboard, you've talked about like the bingo ball spinner. Where do these ideas come from? Like, you know, the Congress people aren't elected to Congress and then handed a whiteboard. Where does that idea come from?
I mean, I think some of it is from being a teacher, like I mentioned. And I think some of it, I was a longtime leader of my kids' Cub Scout pack. And I was really, really good at recruiting Cub Scouts. I mean, I had this whole shtick that was something like this. Do you like s'mores? Gooey, chocolatey, marshmallow s'mores? Then join Cub Scouts. So what happened is I had like 100 of these Cub Scouts. And even worse than that, I had 100 plus Cub Scout parents. Mm. And so I really had to, you know, spend a lot of time thinking about how do I create engaging moments? How do you use visuals? How do you keep people engaged? And I think that's something, like I said, I think every elected official, instead of assuming that what they have to say is important, ought to be really thinking about how can they help others see that. That's on us, not on busy Americans trying to make ends meet.
There's such a push to, especially amongst a lot of Democrats, to push towards the center to get the most votes possible. You haven't really done that. You've been a strong progressive, regardless of that, you know, that trend to push towards the center. How come you've stayed strong in that? Because you're in Orange County too, so I can't imagine that's necessarily easy to stick to your guns.
Some of the things that divide us are less about left and right, and they're more about the way that corporate power is used to squeeze out opportunity and prosperity from American families. And so in my career as a consumer advocate, I ran a major foreclosure program here at the invitation of then Attorney General, now Senator and Vice Presidential nominee Kamala Harris. And I would take phone calls, that program I ran, from homeowners all over the state, scared that they were going to lose their homes to foreclosure. Never did I have a single homeowner say, I'm a Republican or I'm a Democrat. They simply said, I'm a homeowner and I'm worried about keeping a roof over my family's head. So nobody likes to get cheated. Nobody. And so that is a universal value. So when you're standing up for things like clear policies, anti-corruption, campaign finance reform, making sure that, you know, people are following the laws and they don't think they're above the law, which a lot of corporations really build into their business model, that they'll break the law and see if they get caught. And if they do, they can pay the fine.
Wow. So how did you get into politics? Was it, what made you decide that that was the way to go?
But one day I just lost my mind and decided to run. I mean, I'll never forget sitting down with the political consultant that I hired that helped me with my first run. And he said, so what made you want to do this crazy thing? Mm. And all of a sudden I was like, oh man, he might be right. Like, this might be a little bit crazy. But a lot of it came out of watching Elizabeth Warren, watching Kamala Harris, wanting to make a difference in people's lives. So I loved being a professor, or trying to train the next generation of consumer advocates and warriors for justice. But I also saw through some of my research, you know, I saw the research actually changing the policy. And that's a pretty slow path as an academic. I mean, by comparison, Congress is speedy, and that's really saying something. So I think for me, it was really about how can I make Americans' lives better? I felt like I was doing that with my research. I feel like I'm trying to do that with my work in Congress.
What is the kind of Democratic leadership you would like to see?
I think one of the things we have to focus on is making sure that we're hearing from the vibrancy of our party. And this can't be about having a person of color in a role. This can't be about, having big breakfast meetings that everyone's invited to attend. This has to be about real voice and about real opportunities to lead. And so one of the things that I think the Democratic Party is facing is a challenge in how to create diverse, multi-generational leadership. We have a number of wonderful senior leaders. They've been leading the party for a long time. You mentioned Barbara Lee, terrific example. Obviously, leadership like Speaker Pelosi and Steny Hoyer, wonderful leaders. But we also need to be developing the next generation of leaders. And how do we harmonize that? And that is as much about kind of different coming out of different moments in time, having different experiences, more than it is a moderate versus progressive thing. And I think that's something that people who write about politics, they love to do this moderate versus progressive thing. But it's also about, you know, I listen, Warren's one of my best friends. I listened to her give her stump speech, and she talks about how she went to college for $50 a semester. Mm. That just has no bearing. Like, I can't. Did you leave off three zeros? It was like $50,000 a year when I went.
Wow.
Right? And wow. So I think it's making sure that we're reflecting all of those different experiences. So when we talk about a veteran, someone who was a veteran in Vietnam, a very different experience than someone was who a veteran in Afghanistan. And those are examples of needing to lift up and recognize the diversity within the Democratic Party. And I think that's going to be a real challenge for Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. And frankly, I think it's something that voters need to be prepared to help with. It's not, we're not just going to limp over the finish line to Election Day. We're going to run over the finish line with plenty of gas left in our tank to help shape that governing agenda.
You mentioned senior leadership in the Democratic Party. Should some of that leadership even sort of actively step aside and go, I'm going to make way for those new people? Is that something that, because I feel a lot of the younger members of the party feel like, you've done a good job up there, now step aside and let the young people, let some of the new voices get in there.
I think this is and it's something that every institution and every organization faces. You know, corporations face it, nonprofits face it. And I think we've seen one of the things Speaker Pelosi did that I think was really terrific was make sure that a significant number of freshmen had the ability to chair subcommittees, because that's not just about holding the gavel and practicing tapping. It's really about deciding what issues are going to be heard. What policy projects are we going to work on? So I think we will continue to evolve. I think I've endorsed 28 House challengers, and they are so terrific. And I think this is a little bit of the secret story of 2020. There's so much focus on the presidency and on taking back the Senate. And how can we not be focused on those things? Those have to be priorities one and two. So I think what a lot of people haven't had the chance to see yet, and what I can't wait for the American people to see, is the incredible leadership that we're going to elect in the House of Representatives, adding to what we did in 2018, adding new and diverse voices.
You just started a political action committee. How are you choosing? How are you identifying who you're going to back?
Yep. So my leadership organization is called Truth to Power. And what I'm looking for is people who I think will deliver on that mission. And so this, for me, this means looking at several different things. Have people had life experiences that are going to let them understand the challenges American families are facing? So, for example, Candace Valenzuela, an Afro-Latino, whose parents were in the military, who was homeless, for whom education and schools were her safety and security and pathway. When Candace says she's going to fight for education, she's not kidding, right? when we hear someone like Mondaire Jones talk about the challenges that his mom faced as a single mom, or you hear someone like Richie Torres talking about growing up in public housing, these are people who are going to bring a commitment to the real challenges of the American people. Corporations didn't get them where they got, and they're not going to be fighting for corporations when they get there. None of our candidates take corporate PAC money, and that's really, really important. That is a transformational change that we're making in Congress.
I think one of the things that I feel like has got to be frustrating as a member of Congress specifically is your term is 2 years. Is it hard to not just always be running for re-election and working the phones trying to get money for re-election?
So you know what's interesting? I thought that would be really annoying. Right. This was something that you go to run. People are like, you're going to have to run every 2 years. Are you prepared to do that? I actually love campaigning because I think it is easy for people to get too distant from their voters, to not be having those conversations, to not be reaching out to people. And so I actually like the campaigning part. We need campaign finance reform. Everybody knows that. Everybody wants that, except the corporations that are buying influence in Washington. You know, the American public across party lines broadly agrees that corporations and lobbyists have too much influence. But the actual campaigning part, the picking up the phone and calling a voter, the listening to someone's concerns, those are really important parts of this job. And probably if we didn't campaign every 2 years, I'm not sure that people would take as much time with that as they should.
What do you recommend in this moment that people do to sort of like who feel like they're that America, like a lot of people feel like Democrats don't generally want to stand up to corporate power. What do you recommend people do, your constituents, the people who are inspired by your viral videos? What do you recommend people do if they want to turn this around?
Yep. So they should absolutely be pressing their representative about corporate PAC money and about specifically asking, how will you stand up to corporate power? That is an important question. And I think too often the buckets of issues are, you know, environment bucket. Mm-hmm. There's the gun violence prevention bucket. There's the, you know, right. And so we ought to be thinking about, how are you going to create a more fair economy? And asking some of those bigger questions. And so I think that's a really important thing people can be doing, volunteering for those candidates, really taking a hard look at how candidates are funding their campaign and how they're spending their time. And I would say that also another thing I would just encourage people to do, make phone calls. Hear the voices of other Americans. That is my fundamental obligation as a representative, but it's actually incumbent on all of us as you know, little d, part of a democracy, to be listening to other people. So pick up the phone, call some voters, whether it's a city council race or for Joe Biden, Kamala Harris, you're going to become a more thoughtful, more educated, more sort of sympathetic citizen as a result of doing that work.
Congresswoman, thank you so much for joining us. We really do appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Thank you for not pulling out the whiteboard on us and telling us how we're doing wrong. I appreciate that too. Congresswoman Katie Porter represents California's 45th district in Congress, and she's the first Democrat to hold that seat since it was created in 1953, or what Hurry calls the good old days.
If you're saying because it was 6 years after the independence of India, then possibly.
That's exactly what I was saying.
Learn about the progressive candidates across the country she's supporting through her Truth to Power PAC at truthtopowerpac.com.
Up next, we'll talk to Caroline Rose Giuliani.
As in Rudy Giuliani, who is her dad, and whose politics she's come out in direct opposition to, although they do still talk. Sometimes.
We want to hear your reactions to the conversation we're having on Politically Reactive. We love getting your calls, especially when they say nice things.
I work as a custodian at UW Oshkosh during a coronavirus spike. And I want to say thank you. Thank you for the show, Politically Reactive. I'm up to my eyeballs all day, every day, every waking moment, paying attention to what's going on in our world to try to figure out the best way that I can get my head together to deal with it. And your take on it and the ability to find a way to laugh at just about every situation really helps. Thank you. Thank you for Politically Reactive. You guys rock.
Oshkosh. But gosh, that was a nice message.
Oh, did the new shipment of dad jokes come in, Hurry?
You can say whatever you want when you call us at 917-477-6525. Come on, what's that number again?
Again, that's 917-477-6525. Or use the hashtag Politically Reactive on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram to tell us what you think and what you want.
And if you want more people to experience the wonder of Politically Reactive, share episodes you like and give us a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. It does make a difference. Also, make sure you subscribe if you haven't already, and tell your family to subscribe, and your friends and your neighbors. Otherwise, you'll never hear from us again.
Caroline Rose Giuliani is a Los Angeles-based writer and director who creates content on mental health and sexuality.
She's also the daughter of Rudy Giuliani, the former New York City mayor who's now Donald Trump's lapdog / personal lawyer.
She started arguing with her dad about politics early on, like when she was 12 years old.
And she recently wrote a piece for Vanity Fair with the subtle headline, "Rudy Giuliani is my father. Please, everyone, vote for Joe Biden and Kamala Harris." Hey, Caroline, thank you so much for joining us on Politically Reactive.
Thanks for having me. I'm a big fan of both of you guys.
Stop it.
Yes, I love it. the word both is crucial there.
It's true.
We really wanted to have you on, I think, partly because we talk a lot on the show, and also I think post-Trump election, about the importance of people on the left in particular to talk to family members about their politics, about what they believe in. And especially like we talk about during Thanksgiving, you might have to ruin Thanksgiving. But if that means, you know, questioning a family member that has troubling politics and sharing your point of view, that's crucial. Now, what happens, though, when that family member happens to be your father and your father happens to be Rudy Giuliani?
Are you asking me? Or are you just
asking you? It's not rhetorical. I literally want to know, what is it like arguing with your father?
I try to separate, you know, the private from the public, which is a very hard thing to do. And that's sort of what changed here, which is that I felt like I could no longer keep my, it's not that I was private or hid my feelings, but I never considered myself like in politics in any way. So I didn't really feel like it was my, and not that it wasn't my right, but it wasn't my prerogative to like go out there making speeches or anything like that. But at this point in our country, I just felt like we are in such a state of crisis and moral crisis that this doesn't even feel like politics to me anymore. Like, I don't feel like I'm going out there becoming like super political. I feel like I'm just going out there expressing my feelings about our country's soul and our morality and ethics.
Has he responded to the Vanity Fair article, which, by the way, is fantastic and it's gutsy? And I think, I think it does take a lot of character to say that, like, this is public. I'm going to challenge my father, who's a very notable person, and I want America to know that I'm with them. Has he seen it? Has he responded to it? Or do you care?
Of course, there's like some biological thing where you always want your parent to be proud of you, I think, that's what I think anyway, and that's what I've sort of like learned over the years. We haven't spoken since the article, and sort of a way that I've come to peace with whatever the result of that is that like I know that I would be very proud if my daughter wrote that, even if it was totally in opposition to me.
I mean, you're in this rare position where you have like a direct line to someone who has so much influence. Do you ever call your dad? And it doesn't just need to be now since he started working for Trump, but even before then, where you were like, "Dad, what are you doing? Like, that is not like, no, Ukraine. What are you talking about? Like, stop."
I've definitely had those types of conversations. And I think one of the things that like I talk about in the article is like how those conversations, like, even if we would connect or, you know, I'm a pretty good communicator. And so I think like I'll get some points across, but then, you know, nothing really changed practically. And so that's one of the reasons that I felt like, you know, I can't change my father's mind. I can keep having conversations with him and try, but something I can do with this mini platform I have is to talk to America and see if we can all come together and vote and make a choice together that will turn our country around to a place of like empathy and decency.
At the same time that we were sort of booking for the show, this story breaks with Borat and your dad's appearance in Borat. We have not seen the movie. It has not come out as we record. You've been clear that you don't really want to talk about that, which I understand and respect. Can you talk about why you don't want to talk about that, or why it's hard to talk about, or what the position it puts you in?
Yeah, I definitely didn't want to talk about it, in part because I haven't seen it, and I definitely, like, I try very hard to not speak up unless I'm certain that what I'm saying is backed by facts and not fake news. But yeah, I think that this, talking about these types of things is sort of symptomatic of what's going on in our politics in general, is that we're focusing on the wrong things. And, you know, just the same way that I think all of the Hunter Biden stuff is such a distraction and bad for us in that way, because we can't talk about real policy and like issues that really need to be changed. Like, climate change is like we have such a ticking clock on that. We need to get Joe Biden in office so that we can start making change in that arena. And those things, I think, are just sidelined by these like sideshows. And this is just feels like another sideshow to me, knowing just the same that everybody else knows, and just having seen just the picture and the tweeting. It's just, we only have so much time and attention as human beings, and I think it should be spent on like the crisis that we're in.
Mm-hmm. I mean, this seems like, you know, certainly an extreme example of like you having to deal with the impact of your father's political choices or personal choices. Like, you know, you're not part of those things and you have to deal with the backlash of it. And your father's had a really, I mean, one of the more remarkable lives, I think, in recent history. I mean, he starts by busting the mob, right? Then he runs for mayor and wins in a very democratic city. He's hated, not even kind of hated, very hated. He cleans up Times Square, but that also involves in potentially, quote unquote, moving homeless people.
Right.
Then 9/11 happens. He's a huge national hero. He's America's mayor. You see him at the Yankees games. He's on Saturday Night Live and drag. Like, everybody loves him. Then he, like, runs for president. It doesn't happen. And now he's a yes man to Donald J. Trump. Now, you're on this roller coaster.
Some I was just going to say right. You should make a roller coaster called the Rudy Giuliani. So I'm just going up and down with you. Like, yeah.
But at some point, it's just like, it's just going down.
What
are we
gonna... What is it going
to... Underground.
I mean, but then... Yeah, it's going underground. I mean, how, as someone who, you know, certainly rode it next to him when you were a kid and now is still on that ride, you know, more tangentially, like, how do you deal with this? Because obviously, like... These questions are uncomfortable, and it is hard to answer for. So your dad is in the Borat movie, and this happens, but that's your reality. That's what you've dealt with since you were a kid. How do you ride that ride?
First and foremost, important thing is therapy.
right.
You know, I used to be in a space where if anyone asked me a question about my father, or if anyone even knew who my father was because I was trying to hide it, I would get angry and, like, you know, just shut down, not want to talk to them, not want to be their friend, you know? And as I've matured, I've learned that people are interested in that. And of course they're going to be interested in that because it's fucking crazy. And like, that doesn't mean that that's the reason that they're my friend or anything like that. And then sometimes they're inquiring because they care about me. Or so I think it's like trusting my intuition when I'm getting those questions about the person's motivation and recognizing that humans are human and interested in interesting things. And that doesn't necessarily devalue their interest in me, or that doesn't devalue what I have to offer.
You brought this up a little bit. There was a point in your life where you used your mom's name as your last name, and then you decided to take on the Giuliani name, which is a name that, even if you're not related to Rudy Giuliani, it's a very specific name that even people who probably aren't related to your dad have to deal with the stigma. So yeah. What made you decide to actually take that name back on?
So yeah, I didn't even use my mom's name. I used a totally different name, Rose. Basically was sort of like living my life hiding things from people. And one of the things that I really care a lot about in art and filmmaking is helping people live in a way that's like true and free. And so it was creating a lot of these like subconscious issues in me to have to, like, you know, not tell a story about my childhood to a friend or whatever it was. It just felt like I wasn't allowed to be my truest self because that is a part of me. And so once I got more confidence in who I was like, oh yeah, okay, I can handle, I'm Rudy Giuliani's daughter and I'm fucking awesome. Like, you know, I've made mistakes, whatever, but like I have a lot to offer. Like I have great stories to tell. And a lot of those stories have to do with this like crazy childhood. And that doesn't mean that I'm like riding coattails or anything like that, you know?
Well, first of all, that's a great name for your book. I'm Rudy Giuliani's daughter and I'm fucking awesome. I just want to make sure you take that with
Thank you.
You.
I love that, yeah.
At any point, did you think to yourself, am I out of the will?
I'm still not sure about that. Yeah. I have thought of that. Yeah. But it also, you know, like, you know, that's so much less important than speaking your truth.
Well, you've definitely convinced me to take on my family name, W. Kamau Ben Carson.
Oh my God.
I've been hiding that for a long time. Harry didn't even know.
And I'll hook you up with my Vanity Fair editor. So
exactly. I've got a piece I got to write too. Arguing with my dad, Ben Carson.
Carolyn Rose Giuliani is a Los Angeles-based writer and director. You can read her article about her relationship with her dad and politics at vanityfair.com. And if you want to hear me geeking out about what it's like to grow up in Gracie Mansion, Stick around after the show's credits. One thing I learned from this segment is that Rudy Giuliani's last name is pronounced Giuliani, not fucking Giuliani.
Having lived in New York for a couple years, that is what how I thought it was pronounced too when I heard it on the streets of New York.
Fucking Giuliani.
Yeah.
Disney store in Times Square, fucking Giuliani.
And up next, we hear from another New Yorker, a new citizen, and a first-time voter who has some special insights from our friend Hari. One thing I want to do today is talk about my friends at the ACLU. They are all about making sure that people have a voting plan and also that people know their vote, their rights on Election Day. You can find out more at aclu.org/vote-now. Here's some things they want you to know how to know your rights on Election Day. One, if the polls close while you're still in line, stay in line. You have the right to vote no matter what they tell you. If you make a mistake on your ballot, you are allowed to ask for a new one. These are all things you need to know because they may be like, you're not allowed. You can actually hold up this card. I'm going to put it on Twitter from the ACLU. If the machines are down at your polling place, you are allowed to ask for a paper ballot. So they have to have paper ballots if the machines go down. And if you run into any problems or have questions on Election Day, you can call the Election Protection Hotline at 1-866-OUR-VOTE. 1-866-OUR-VOTE. That's O-U-R-V-O-T-E. Go to the aclu.org/vote-now for more information.
So my dad, Ravi Kundabolu, became a citizen this year after living in this country since 1978. We're going to find out why he chose to do that during this interview. But I also want to ask him how he felt about voting for the first time, something he had never done before in any country.
Yeah, I was excited to be present for this conversation because it felt good to meet your other dad. Let's talk to Hari's dad.
Hey, Dad, thanks for being on our podcast.
You're welcome.
You're planning to vote for the first time because you just became a citizen of the United States after being here for at least 40 years. 42 years. How come you decided that you wanted to be a citizen now after all this time?
Well, until 2016, I thought, you know, I don't have to become a citizen unless I need it. But from 2017, I am sitting on the roller coaster in America. 1 week is happy and another week is tensions. Something is going to happen.
Wait, so Dad, so if it wasn't for the Trump election, then you wouldn't have become a citizen then?
The reason I did it, one time Trump threatened he may send some immigrants back to their countries, that kind of thing. And there is a problem after I'm working more than 40 years, so I expect my benefits. If he passed the rule saying that we're going to stop the Social Security 50% cut to the immigrants, that's going to affect me. So there are situations like this when somebody like me getting old, depend on my benefits and everything. What happens if he says we stop the Medicare benefits to the immigrants? So the situation, so I scared a little bit. First time after 39 years. This is the time I had to take the citizenship.
Dad, like growing up, you know, your father was a politician and you came from a political family. Has that impacted how you view politics? And also, did you vote when you were in India?
I never voted in India.
You never voted?
I never voted in India. The voting, India is 21 years and above, you get the voting powers in India, 21 years. Later on, they changed it to 18 when I came back. So when I was 21 years, I was in college. That time, hardly 5% of the children can vote. They don't have any interest to vote. So this is the first time I'm going to vote in my life.
Wow.
First time. But I know the value of the vote. These votes can bring down the dictators. These votes can bring down the bad presidents. This is the time everybody have to decide And they had to get out from the house and they had to vote it. Whether you do it mailing a ballot or stand in the line. I know I've been watching on TV, there are some states, the people are standing for 7-8 hours. They're waiting, but sometimes they come back next day again standing in the line because the previous day they couldn't vote it. So determination is there, the people willing to vote. So let us see what happens.
And your father
was I'm sorry, let us follow up the my Harry's question, the other one. Even though my father was a politician, he's the only one who's a politician. He had a very good name, where he became an assemblyman. But we never had any interest of in the politics.
This election makes the most sense now because of everything that happened. This is the, for you, like the best time to finally vote.
Because I've been watching last 4 years, a lot of confusion in this country, not only for the immigrants, is citizens. If the president is not following, if the president is not paying the taxes, what rights the president have to ask the citizens to pay the taxes? What happens if this, all the citizens revolt, not pay the taxes? How the government is going to run it? This is not right. Because of one party has a majority and using, abusing their powers, and what happens if the other party is going to win it, they come into the power, they may do the other way. That's not right. And this way is what's going to happen in the future elections. People are not going to have any interest to vote. They don't get out from the home. They don't go to vote. So this thing has to be stopped now. People are not worried about the economy. They're worried about the future. Look at the people who are dying in this country. Come on. The richest country, number one country, all these years. When I come to this country and when I go back to India, say I am come from America, I used to have a special respect. Not anymore. Not anymore.
Have you listened to our podcast before?
I did not. First time.
His first time listening is when he's on it. Yeah. I have one more question, Hari.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah.
Do you think Hari is funny?
I can't say he's funny. Yeah. I went to one place to watch Hari's performance. So then... I thought, okay, he has to improve more. When he, first time he was on the TV, Jimmy Kimmel.
Hold up, wait a minute.
All right, let's hear a little bit of Hari's 2007 appearance on Jimmy Kimmel.
Oh, we don't need to do this. We don't need to do this.
Yes, we do.
Oh,
yes,
God
we do.
Damn it.
Every year, the U.S. Comedy Arts Festival in Aspen features the very best up-and-coming comedians from all over this great country. We have one of them with us tonight. He's on his way to Colorado. You can see him there February 28th through March 3rd. That's a long trip for him to be on his way, by the way. Please welcome Hari Kundabalu.
I'm 24 years old. I'm a deer caught in headlights. I was an immigrant rights organizer. I had to take the day off from work just to do the set. I had no idea why I was on television.
Let's hear some more. Let's hear some more.
No, oh, God. Let me be honest with you, ladies and gentlemen. I've been really nervous about this particular show. I'm a young comic. They gave me this great spot on Jimmy Kimmel Live, and I've just been really nervous about it. All week, my stomach's been acting up. My stomach's been a mess. And for a while there, I thought maybe I wasn't actually nervous. Maybe I was pregnant. That's, of course, not possible, because I'm obviously, you know, a virgin. That's the first joke I ever wrote when I was 16 years old, and it's still very... painful to me, and not that much fun to tell anymore. Okay, first of all, it should be noted that that joke about being a virgin I wrote when I was 16 years old. It was the first joke I ever wrote. I wrote it for my election speech in high school, which I won. And the fact that it survived all the way to television tells you how good a joke writer I was.
Nope, just let it go.
And if you want to know whether the joke was still true in 2007, it's none of your fucking business.
Yikes. Let's keep going.
Okay, Then at that time also I thought, this comedy should be sidelined maybe for a hobby, but he has to work.
Nine to five job. Yeah.
Then when he went to the London School of Economics and he completed and he wrote me a letter saying, Dad, I completed as you guys requested my master's, but I'm not going to work 9-to-5 job and I'm going to settle in stand-up comedy. So by that time, Harry already got some recognition in Seattle here and there, and he already have some good name in Borden College and there. Then both parents, both of us, we gave permission, go ahead. We did our job, we educated you, and now you've grown up, and go ahead. So later on, we were watching. Yes, I am very proud of Harry. He's been doing, and I also appreciate you and giving a hand to my son to come up. You both are good friends. That's what Hari needs it. Hari needs a friend like you to help him all the way. I'm really thankful for that. I'm very thankful.
Well, thank you for saying that. I appreciate it. I sort of feel like I'm not exactly the same as his dad, but I feel like I'm sort of a dad junior to him. Sort of, I'm trying to help you keep him on the straight and narrow. So we're both raising him.
Yeah.
So. Thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thank you.
All right, Dad.
Thank you.
Thanks for doing this.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
That's my dad, Ravi Kundabolu. After 42 years in this country, he became a citizen in 2020. And next Tuesday, he'll be voting for the first time in his life. Unless his vote is suppressed.
And that's it for this week. Thanks to Congresswoman Katie Porter and Caroline Giuliani.
And a very special thanks to my father, Ravi Kundabolu.
Keep tweeting and Facebooking us your comments and questions using the hashtag PoliticallyReactive.
Or leave us a message at 917-477-6525. That's 917-477-6525.
And once again, as I talked about earlier, listen to the ACLU and know your voting rights. You can go to aclu.org/vote-now. aclu.org/vote-now.
Kamau and I both have Netflix specials. Also, if you have a machine that plays podcasts, which I assume you do since you're listening to this one, listen to me on WTF with Mark Maron.
Politically Reactive is a production of Topic Studios and Warner Media Podcast Network. Executive producers are Maria Zuckerman and Christy Gressman.
And me, Hari Kundabolu.
And me, W. Kamau Bell.
The show is produced by Matt Martin and Malachi Seeger-Sakir. Will Stanton engineers and mixes the show.
And thanks, as always, to Brontes Purnell for providing music for the show. Thanks for listening to Politically Reactive. Vote!
Vote. I do have a question as like a... As a New Yorker, as a lifelong New Yorker who remembers you as a six-year-old. Which is so strange. But, like, one, what was it like living in Gracie Mansion? Two, there's a famous, you know, your father's inauguration speech is really famous in part because your brother kept interrupting him. And eventually Chris Farley played your brother on Saturday Night Live. When your brother was doing that, even as a kid, were you like, what are you doing? Stop doing that. Why are you doing this?
So to the inauguration question, if you actually go back and look at any of those pictures, I'm wearing a hat that is falling completely over my head. So even if I could remember to that time, I wouldn't have been able to see anything. It was my god sister's hand-me-down hat, and it was like way too big for me. So there are these pictures of like the hats up to here, up to my nose. But in terms of what it was like to grow up in Gracie Mansion, I mean, it was so unique. And I knew it was unique because obviously I visited my friends and the apartments that they lived in and stuff. But, you know, now as an adult looking back, I'm like, wow, I had a backyard, a dog who could like run around. Like I had a house in the middle of New York City. So I had like the best of both sort of lifestyles.
That's so funny to me just because your answer is a very New York answer, which is like, because Gracie Mansion is Gracie Mansion, but as a lifelong New Yorker, you're just like, I'm happy I had a backyard.
I mean, it's crazy. It was like, I had a swing, like as a kid, that's like a personal swing. It's like such a privilege. But then of course it was very, you know, unusual. Like, there's always people in your house. There's, like, a staff. You have bodyguards. Like, you know, I was very grateful that my time there was from when I was, like, 4 to 12. Because by the time I got to age 12, I was, like, entering my rebellious phase and starting to do the whole, like, ditching your bodyguards thing. So, like, it would have been ugly, I think, if I had bodyguards when I was any older. So, yeah, but it was very unusual. I remember there was, like, a time when they were having, because they had city events in the on the main floor, and then we lived on the top floor, but we still used the main floor whenever we wanted to. And I remember, like, running through some event, and, like, a reporter pulled me aside, and I was, like, 5 years old. But even at that age, I knew you don't talk to reporters. Like, I was like, I have to go. So I think it was, like, complicated, but definitely, you know, New Yorkers, like, growing up in New York makes you so independent, so young. And so this just added a layer to that of, like, sort of seeing into the adult world, I think.